Like I carry these mala beads. And I might be, say, at the, my usual example, a checkout stand at a supermarket. You don't have supermarkets, I guess, in paradise there are no supermarkets. It's a nice thing, a supermarket. It satisfies every oral thing that I have developed over 63 years of nurturing it. And it's late in the day, and I'm at the checkout counter, and I'm tired and hungry, and I'm fantasizing what I'm going to cook. And there are three people in the long line, because I've got more than 10 items. And I'm in the long item, and I've already read the Inquirer and the Star. The last time. And the woman who's at the head of the line, her groceries are done, and it comes to $100 and some odd. And after they tell her how much it is, she reaches into this voluminous bag to try to find her checkbook, which she then proceeds to fill out very carefully, including the upper section in the checkbook with the date and the whole thing. And I can feel myself, the steam rising inside me. How inconsiderate you. And then I feel the beads. And the beads are saying, hey, hey, across planes of consciousness. You really want to stay there? Is that the most interesting place? She should have been. Then I get done and I go home and I cook the dinner and I eat it, but I'm still angry at the woman. And I got to see my therapist to work out the anger to the woman and the symbolic significance of the. Bleh. And this voice is calling across to me, hey, you sure you want to buy into this one? And it's coming from Ram, 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 Ram. And what it does is it flips channels. And I have an entirely different curriculum at that moment. My frustration becomes the datum. Frustrated, good. What are you frustrated about? Holding on? What are you holding on to? Oh, you're holding on, you think there's a rush. Where are you rushing to? Isn't this the moment you've been living for? Isn't standing in this checkout counter the absolute essence? Why, is there less here than there is anywhere else? When you get home, will it be better? It'll just be a different neurosis. How absurd. Where am I rushing to? Have I stopped to look at the beauty of each of these human beings? Do I realize these are all the beloved in drag? Do I even see who's around me? What am I doing? What am I doing? This peristaltic contractions in my stomach that is saying I'm hungry. Why am I busy? I'm hungry. Why aren't they just peristaltic contractions? Look, there's hunger. Why do I have to buy into all of it so thick? If I don't buy into it, does it mean I'm dissociating? Is this... I mean, I have all of the psychological language to explain why if I don't get frustrated at that checkout counter, I am in denial. But it's not interesting enough because it's all single plane talk. And the fun for me is the flip of realizing I've been had. I got caught again. I got caught. And how many times do you and I get caught each day? In making what is relatively real, absolutely real. Our businesses, our travel, our desires, our sexual gratification, our oral stuff, our aesthetics, our intellectual gratification, our important work. Where's the sense of humor? Where's the cosmic giggle? Where's the lightness? Where's the playfulness? Where's the seeing behind the veil of it? And I would say that since 1961, for the last 34 years now, my major effort has been to extricate myself from my ego reality without denying my ego reality. So that I end up having cultivated another plane of consciousness, not at the expense of the first plane, but in conjunction with it. So that you are living in two planes simultaneously. Not sequentially, but simultaneously. So it is both real and it is relatively real. You are both an ego and a soul. It's another way of saying it. That you so short shrift yourself by your single plane definition of what existence is about. There's a statement in the wisdom teachings that says, one does nothing and nothing is left undone. One does nothing and nothing is left undone. In this culture in which the big game is burnout, from too much to do and too little time, what could the wisdom statement mean? One does nothing and nothing is left undone. What I hear is I hear two planes of consciousness. That there's a part of you that is sitting inside doing nothing, which is just awareness. And then there is all of the doing. And the question is, where is your identification? Is your identification with the doer or the beer? Is it an either or is it both and? I'm talking to you, and I'm not talking to you. You are listening, and you are not listening. You are just being inside, and then there is listening happening. What may seem really intellectually passing interest to you, what I'm talking about is the escape from suffering at the deepest metaphysical level. I know how to convey it. That I don't care how good your ego game is, it is not freeing you from suffering. Because to the extent you as an ego are interdependent with anything in the universe, and that is all changing all the time, there is a fear root in that behavior. And if there is a fear root, there is suffering. Now, for those of you that are Buddhists that are getting uneasy with what I'm talking about when I use the word soul, let me say that that also is a passing show. You use the soul as a bootstraps operation to free you from the ego. And then you pull back into spacious awareness that embraces everything in order to incorporate soul and ego into yourself, into big S self. So we're talking about three planes of consciousness now. Ego, you are your parents' child, you are from a certain country, you are a certain religion, you are a certain gender, you have a certain set of desires and goals and plans. That's one level. Second level, you are still a unique, separate entity. You are a soul. You are taking birth. You have taken this birth. You've manifested in this incarnation, which has all of its storyline, as part of the way you're working through your stuff. You're not only working through on the physical plane, by the way, you're working through on all the other planes too, archetypal and all. You live on, the soul's functioning on using many planes to work out its curriculum. As the karmic pull on the soul gets lighter and lighter and lighter, the soul remembers more deeply the yearning to come back into the pure awareness of which it is part. Three planes. This is what I'm asking of you. Three planes. First, personality, physical body, physical material reality. Plane one. Plane two, the witness or the soul or a separate entity that is working on itself through its incarnation and has equanimity. It is still separate from this third plane in which there is only one of it or zero of it. The top one embraces the bottom two. Each higher plane embraces the planes beneath it. It is hierarchical, but not oppressive. So what I first thought my job was back in 61, saying, I've been had, I've been caught into the physical, psychological plane, I got to get out of this thing, which led me into a renunciate path, turned out to leave me still what you'd call a horny celibate, a still somebody pushing away something. I wasn't free at all. I got really high. I can show you a thousand ways to get high. And many of you know them as well as I do. I mean, you can fast, you'll get high. Go up on that hill and ski down, you'll get high. You'll have moments when you'll transcend. And during that moment, you forget about all your problems. But they don't go away, they're there. And then I realized that I had to embrace the form into the formless. I had to embrace the ego into the soul. I had to see that the ego's dance, my dance in relationships and all that, was, it, in a way, it wasn't very interesting. And in another way, it was the grist for the mill of my soul to do its work. And I would say my life is my soul work now. And then the soul keeps feeling this yearning to be free of separateness. Not to deny separateness, to be free of the attachment to separateness. The death from the attachment to ego into soul is one death. The death of the separateness of soul into the totality is another death. To fully die in these two ways leaves you fully alive on all three planes. This is really far out stuff. And that's the whole game of lest ye die, ye cannot be born again. Basically, this is what we're talking about. Although a lot of the people that use it may not understand that. They're using it within the ego structure. And it's scary to die because you've built up such a structure that is keeping you efficiently as a separate entity functioning on this plane. The problem is there is fear in it. There's fear of growing old. There's fear of growing impotent. There's fear of losing your money. There's fear of losing your health. There's fear of losing your hearing and sight and all of that. From the soul's point of view, losing your sight. What do you know? New curriculum. I mean, you think about meditators. What do? They go into a meditation room, take no books, no pictures, no pencil, and they sit there. And they draw in their awareness. They go inward. They draw in their awareness from their ears hearing, their eyes seeing. They don't move around much. They just sit there. Funny, when you get really old, you lose your sight, your hearing, and you got arthritis. Is there a message in it? Is there a possibility that it is defining a possibility of another stage of life in which you can go inward to find maybe what you got you lost because you were so busy living out the outer journey?
Now, just again, what is it we're waking up to? And if you, I've laid a lot of stuff on very heavy this morning, and I don't want to, I'm sure it's very confusing, as it is to me. But basically, out of the multiplicity of planes of consciousness, we are presently attending to three planes of consciousness. One of them is the physical, sensory, thoughtful structures of this plane, the reality that people, my father says, come down to reality, Richard, which means get your checkbook together and get a job and all that. I mean, he used to say that. This is ghosts of Christmas past. And that's what he meant by reality. And that's what the society in which we're living primarily means by reality. It has to do with the physical, psychological plane. And then the second plane we're talking about is the one that stands apart from that physical plane and witnesses it. And it is that second thing that we are calling, for want of another term, soul, or witness, or individual awareness. In Hinduism, we call the jivatman, the separate identity still. You're still a separate person, a separate awareness. And then you see from that point that the entire incarnation of the first channel is the working out of your karma as a soul. So I can talk to you. Now, if you get those two planes, I could be talking to you on either of those two planes. I could say, hello, fellow souls. Interesting that we all took incarnation here. How's yours been? Has it been interesting? Are you ready to finish with it? Are you hanging in for a while? Is there more to learn? We're talking now as fellow souls, exploring our lives. Then the other one is, on the psychological level, we can meet and say, hey, Aspen's great, and how are you feeling, and what's happening in your life, and we can get involved in the dramas of our life. And remember, this is not a judgmental thing. It's not saying one plane is better than another. What is saying is better is the ability to simultaneously have more than one plane going. That ability to keep more than one plane going is the root of compassion. It is the root of equanimity and wise decision-making and judgment in life. And beginning to realize what the game is about, what you're doing here. The ego never really knows what it's doing here. It's just busy satisfying its needs and making sure it's all safe from the moment. It's trying to stay safe and put off death as long as possible. Because from the ego's point of view, death means the end. From the soul's point of view, it doesn't. That's why when they talk about saints in India or people, they say, at that point, she dropped her body. That's the way they talk about death. That means dropped that particular incarnation. But if you dropped it, you aren't that which was dropped. So that's referring to those two planes of consciousness. And the third thing we're talking about, third plane, is where it all, where form and formless become one, where it becomes, you could call it one, but it's really not one, or it's zero or one or whatever. It could be called awareness, it could be called God, it could be called Allah, it could be called Brahma, it could be called the wisdom state, it could be called, I mean, you can use then all the adjectives of beauty, love, truth, etc. It could be called pure truth. Truth has no form. All forms are relatively true. They're not absolutely true. So what we're dealing with is a level at which awareness, when you draw your awareness back from thoughts, even from the thought of soul, even from the curriculum of the soul, and just keep drawing back, you as a separate entity are just another set of thoughts from where you're sitting inside. And as you draw your awareness back, you begin to expand beyond the boundaries of your separateness. And then you start to experience going outward in which I am no longer in a relationship to you. In actuality, I am you. It is the It's hard to talk about this one. It's where you're going from the second to the third stage. And the quality of this third awareness is that it's everything. It embraces everything within itself. It's not pushing against form to be formless. It's the statement, as I said this morning, form is no other than formless, formless no other than form. They are all within one another. And at that moment, the suffering of the universe is inside of you, not outside of you. And if you can hear that possibility, then you understand where the root of true compassion comes. Because if the suffering is inside of you, then you do what you can to relieve your suffering, even though that your suffering is happening to somebody else. It's our suffering, or it's the suffering. And out of the suffering comes the compassion. And there's nothing personal in it at all. In other words, if you're in pain, I can help you because I'm me and you're you and I empathize with you and it's a relational thing. Let me help you. There's another level entirely in which you and I are part of what is, and your suffering is the suffering, and my ability to offer some help is the ability to offer help. And there's nothing personal in it at all. It is merely one hand. If my hand were caught in the fire and the other hand pulls it out, the first hand doesn't have to say to the second, thank you, because that would put too much distance between them because they're both rooted in the same quality of being. And that's the point where the game becomes interesting. Because then you can't really turn something off as other. There is no other. There is only what is. And so the whole separation of... And then the question is, what happens to your separateness or uniqueness? And in a way, that from that awareness, your separateness and your uniqueness and your incarnation and your whole dance of form is just phenomena arising up into awareness. And out of that gestalt of awareness filters down a harmony, or the Tao they call it, the way of things, which has in it, on your lower planes, your unique manifestation. See if I can say it. Like, each person in this room is a unique entity. You have a unique karmic predicament for a variety of reasons, which we needn't go into at the moment. So you say, well, what shall I do? And I'd say, well, listen. Quiet, empty, and here. It's like the river saying, well, what shall I do? And you're supposed to say, hey, you're supposed to flow downstream. You don't have to say that. If you empty and quiet enough, the river just does its river thing. And you do your thing. And as you're doing your thing, taking care of your child, or changing a flat tire, or struggling with your checkbook, or skiing down the slope, there's no rule book about which thing it should be. Because each person has a unique form of manifesting. You say, but aren't some forms better for everybody than others? Then you get into the question of what we called good and evil this morning. That is, if your form increases the suffering of others, then you've got a karmic predicament to deal with. And you're not listening deeply enough. Because when you are causing suffering to others, ultimately you're causing suffering to yourself. Because there's only one of it anyway. So who are you doing in? Every time I hold a grudge or turn against somebody or make them, put them out of my heart in that sense of pushing them away, what happens is I starve. I close myself down. They're just being who they are, like an idiot or a jerk or a fool or a greedy person. I mean, I have on my holy puja table pictures of all the people that turned me on, like Buddha and Christ and Maharaji and Anandamayi Ma and Mary and all of them. Teresa. And I also have on there, like Newt Gingrich, you know, and Bob Dole. And what happens is in the morning I light my incense and I say, good morning, Buddha. Good morning, Christ. Good morning, Maharaji. Hello, Bob. Hello, Newt. And I can feel my heart contract. And when my heart contracts, I see where my work is. Because I should be able to oppose people whose points of view I disagree with, say no to them, protest against them, do what I can to change them. but not close my heart to the fact that this is a fellow soul on their journey, just like I'm on mine. Because if I put them out of my heart, I make them them. And the minute I do that, I cut myself off from myself. Because Bob Dole is part of me, whether I like it or not. You know? And this is extraordinary to play with these planes of consciousness. This is really the dance. And what as you're quieting into, and the fact is, you say, well, I don't know what you're talking about these other planes. And I'd say that's only because your labeling of your prison cell is so powerful that you're treating all the information that's coming from these other planes, which are going full blast all the time with all of you, is you're treating them like error or interference or confusion because you're so busy being in your storyline. See, we get caught in our drama. Along comes a thought that it's all a cosmic giggle. And you think, oh, my God, I better take an aspirin. I'm getting really irresponsible. I mean, after all, this is serious. Like at the Sava Foundation, we have the Groucho Marx serious glasses on the middle table in the boardroom. So when we're dealing with death and blindness and violence and so on, which you could get serious about, if anybody uses the word serious, they have to put on the serious glasses. So we won't take ourselves too seriously. Now, that doesn't mean we don't do good work and do it responsibly. But the question is where you do it from, not that you do it, but how you do it. Because I can give somebody food, and I can give them that food in a way that it nourishes their belly, and it also brings us closer. And I can give them the same food in a way which nourishes their belly and separates us. And if my act separates us, I am exacerbating the suffering in the universe, even as I give them food. And that's the horrible beauty of a lot of charitable work. People do charity to separate themselves from the hurt by doing good. And the answer is, and you've got to make love to that which you're serving, really. It's a love affair. It's a merging, a blending. And that final awareness is all of it. You're part of all of it. You're part of all of it. And out of that, you hear the unique part the form plays, and the form plays it. When my father was sick, I took care of him because I was his son. That was part of the system that defined the reality of that ego. I'm involved in the political scene in the United States. I'm involved in a concern about people that are poor, and I'm concerned about legislation, and I make my voice heard to my senators and congressmen and president and everybody. That's because I'm part of a nation state. For me to make believe I'm not part of it is going to cost as much as if I get completely embroiled in such a thing that, oh my God, do you see what they did? That's what burns out. The art form is to be the political figure, to be the social figure, to be the family figure, to be the gender figure, to be the whatever role you have, to learn how to be in the roles but not lose that quiet equanimity, the other plane. It doesn't mean you don't dance the forms, the Shiva dance, all the forms, but it means you do it always right here. So that when you look in someone's eyes and you meet a mensch, you meet somebody that has develop these awarenesses, you're looking at yourself, looking at yourself, looking at yourself, and it's just in drag in those different forms. So each of you has a unique part to play in the dance. And you'll see how much suffering you cause when you try to play somebody else's part rather than your own. And you begin to see that nobody's is better or worse. C.S. Lewis said, you don't see the center because it's all center. Everywhere you are, you're the center. And because of the nature of the interdependence of phenomena, everything you do is part of a web. I look at the web of compassion of which I can feel myself dying into being part. And I realize when I'm walking down the street and I see someone reach out to help somebody, almost just naturally reach out to help, I realize that's part of the web of which I'm growing into. The web of, way in which one hand pulls the other out of the fire. So all the practices that we do, see, what we're doing this weekend is we're doing Jnana Yoga, we're doing Bhakti Yoga, we're doing Dhyan Yoga, we're talking about Karma Yoga, we'll talk about Tantra Yoga. Basically, these are devices. Practices are devices to extricate you from a plane of consciousness and help you become aware of another plane of consciousness, and then once you become aware of it, integrate it so that you have both planes of consciousness. When you say a spiritual perspective as opposed to a worldly perspective, we're talking about two perceptual vantage points, two planes of consciousness. And as I say, they're all available to you. It's just acknowledging their existence. So the practices are moving you from one to another. And for the most part, most of us are going from one to two because we got deeply caught in one in our socialization process. We're going from one to two. We're beginning to be aware of three, and those of you that learn practices, and we'll do some of them in the next day, practices that allow you to enter into the third plane, which embraces the lower two, and then you begin to see that there is, the practices are used primarily for ascent, that is climbing this ladder of planes, and then the completion is where this one and this one and this one are all full. In other words, there is an ascent and a descent. You extricate yourself from ego land, from drama land, from as the world turns land, not because it's less than, but because you've been so stuck in it. Once you are free of being stuck in it, then you dance in it. The completion is the joy of incarnation, not the error of it. The error is the entrapment of the soul in the incarnation. The freedom and the play and the joy and the celebration is the soul dancing as the ego, just running through its karma, doing what it has to do, playing its unique part. Now, most of the spiritual literature is focused around planes two and three. Is this too confusing, or were you with me? Yeah. Okay. We'll take questions in a second. See, it's focusing between two and three. It's focusing between the fact that you have already started to extricate yourself from your worldly identity, and then it starts to deal with the relation between the lover and the beloved, between the soul and the one, or the friend, as Rumi was talking about when Jai read it. It's that place of the where you're still separate, but you appreciate the beauty of the totality, and you're slowly dissolving into it. And you're still separate, and then another plane is where you're part of it all. Part of it all, did you end? Well, the experience of you ends, but you're still around, and here you are again. Now, there is a... in the pictures that were in the little booklet you had, there was a picture of a woman whose name is Ananda Mayi Ma. And Ananda Mayi Ma was an absolutely, she left her body at 83 years old in the 80s. Absolutely extraordinary, extraordinary being. She represented the possibility, the human possibility to me. And she was a woman that was revered by tens of millions of people in India who would come just to sit in her presence, to just be near her. The feeling was so of her depth of her being, of her wisdom, of her equanimity. And she was a being who all her life was dancing with those two upper planes, plane two and plane three. And here are two quotes from her that describe her identity on those two planes. Here's the one from plane two. You with me? You hear what I'm... Okay. This is her writing. She said, "This body has lived with father, mother, husband, and all. This body has served the husband, so you may call it a wife. It's prepared dishes for all, so you may call it a cook. It has done all sorts of scrubbing and menial work, so you may call it a servant. But if you look at the thing from another standpoint, you will realize that this being has served none but God. For when I served my father, mother, husband, and others, I simply considered them as different manifestations of the Almighty and served them as such. When I sat down to prepare food, I did as if it were a ritual, for the food cooked was, after all, meant for God. Whatever I did in a spirit of divine service. Hence, I was not quite worldly, absolutely, though always engaged in household affairs. I had but one ideal, to serve all as God, to do everything for the sake of God." There's that ultimate dualism. She sees the beloved everywhere. She sees in each human being another face of the beloved, and she's always serving the beloved. That's the dualist part. Here's the channel three, the non-dualist part. At one point, Paramahansa Yogananda, who was no slouch as a yogi either, asked Anandamayi Ma to tell him something of her life. "Father," she said, "there is little to tell. My consciousness has never associated itself with this temporary body. Before I came on this earth, Father, I was the same. I grew into womanhood, but still, I was the same. When the family in which I had been born made arrangements to have this body married, I was the same. And Father, in front of you now, I am the same. Even afterwards, though the dance of creation changes around me in the hall of eternity, I shall be the same." Just for a moment, before we do questions, look at your life in terms of these three channels. Look at the storyline of your life, the she and he story. Will she, won't she, can she, can't she, did he, didn't he? All of that storyline. This is not a put down, this is appreciation. With appreciation, not judgment. Then find the place that's witnessing all that. You're already in the soul to be seeing all that. Just notice the part of you that's just seeing the whole thing. Seeing the unfolding of your life. And finally, explore where in awareness is that which is the same. It's not going anywhere. It's not coming from anywhere. It's not born. It doesn't die. It's not changing. These are different levels of I. I can be a statement of who I think I am on ego level. I is the soul seeing the storyline unfold. I is the pure awareness that just is. Just is. And souls come and go, and bodies come and go. And you and the beloved are one. There is only the beloved. It's been really interesting to me, whatever it means to be in relationship to a guru. When I first met Neem Karoli Baba, and one of the pictures in your little packages of Neem Karoli Baba, who is also we call him Maharaji, and he's a Mashugana nut. When I met him, just like when I met Ananda Maima, my intellect knew I was in the presence of a great being, meaning a being whose awareness was present. When I was with Maharaji, the experience was not that I was with somebody else. It felt like he was inside of me as well as outside of me, because his awareness wasn't defined by the boundary of his body. At first, my relationship was a relationship with a man who told me what to do and what not to do, and I didn't do any of it. But it was a deep love relationship. And then he died after about 5 years of my knowing him. And he died 22 years ago. And when he died, I thought, uh-oh, I've just lost my connection. But that was absurd, because that wasn't what the experience was. That was the thought form, but that wasn't the experience. The experience was we had connected at the soul level, in which the dropping of his body was only missed by my ego, not by my deeper part of my being. And I started to have the stories and the pictures of him, and we've done a book called Miracle of Love, which we are republishing now. I told the stories thousands of times to people. Then finally we published the book Miracle of Love, and I figured, well, I'm done with that. And then the quality of my being with him changed over the next 10 years or so. And I started to experience the qualities of his being, like humor or rascality or wisdom or emptiness or compassion, tenderness, fierceness, just as qualities, no longer connected with a person, just qualities. And I started to see the world through those qualities. So his cosmic giggle, I'd be sitting at somebody's bedside and I'd suddenly feel the cosmic giggle. And I would be mortified. You're not supposed to giggle when somebody's dying. But the giggle was there. And I kept working with it. And then the qualities started to dissolve into something that I'd call presence. Just the presence of him here. Except there was no more him. And it wasn't like I was merging into him, or I had taken my guru into me, or I had become Maharaji. It wasn't anything like that. It's as if we were both dissolving into that third plane of just awareness. There's bodies coming and going. There's a guru, there's a chela. Ah, so. And here we are. Now that's a love affair. That's a love affair. I've just described a love affair that has gone on now since 1967. 28 years. And in that course of that love affair, I have been transformed, or am transforming, into the beloved. And that, to me, is the art form of that particular method, which is called Guru Kripa, or Grace of the Guru. It's like having an imaginary playmate. I mean, who do you hang out with? Think about it. Imagine hanging out with whoever you think is the wisest human being you've ever met, the most humorous human being you've ever met, also the most compassionate human being you've ever met. Just imagine. I mean, create it for yourself. Just imagine that being. And then run your life by that person. It's like, you notice when you're with a different friend, different things come out in you and you see your own life differently. Well, just imagine having a friend with you who is infinitely humorous, infinitely wise, infinitely compassionate. Forget Maharaji, just imagine that being, and then imagine your relationship to that being, and then start to hang out and allow that whole process to go on in which the transformation occurs. Fascinating process. It's just another yoga.